The Science Inside Podcast. This is The Science Inside with Elna.
Hello and welcome to the show. My name is indeed Elna Schütz. So today on the show, it is about a new medical facility in Port Elizabeth. It's been opened by Aspen Pharmacare, and it's worth 1 billion rand, let me just say it again, and it's created or will create about 500 jobs.
And it will produce various oncology products used to treat cancers. It will also produce a high-potency molecule used to prevent organ rejection and organ transplants. It is also aimed at providing these products at an affordable price.
That all sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
I like medicine to help people in need. Very, very cool. Aspen is actually Africa's biggest maker of pharmaceuticals, which you may or may not know, and they have operations in more than 150 countries. So this particular facility is going to pump out about 3.6 billion tablets a year and package about 3 million bottles a month. And all of this production will start in June.
Wow, wow, wow. That's a lot of production. Like, June is now, basically. This actually is a relocation of production, which normally happens in other countries, including Europe. And 90% of these meds will actually be exported.
Well, it's still great because even though we won't be consuming all of those meds, at least, you know, there's job creation, there's, you know, a concentration here. And it got me thinking about pharmaceuticals. It's obviously quite easy to just pop a pill. Your pain might go away if it's a headache or something not that serious. But have you thought about this level? Just everything that goes into making that one little, like panado that you pop.
I never really think about such. I'm just like, I need this headache to go away. Panado, come to me.
Bam.
Yeah.
Done.
But according to Forbes, the average drug development by a major pharmaceutical company costs at least $4 billion, and it can be as much as $11 billion to bring it to the market.
Sure.
Plus, this whole process takes a lot of time. We're looking at about 10 years for a new medicine to complete its journey from initial discovery to the marketplace. And the clinical trials alone take about 6 to 7 years on average.
It's a long time if you think about, yes, it's going to help a lot of people, but still, over a decade until that little pill is, you know, safe to use. They know what all those side effects are. You know, all that little writing on the little, what do you call it, the insert that nobody
no
reads.
I actually read those things because I get psyched out about the side effects of pills. So I never want to not know what's going on when I'm taking this pill.
Okay, you are one of the like 2% of people that do that. I'm just going to guess a number there. But we do want to know a little bit about where do our pills come from? How does this whole process of medicine work? So that's what we are going to be looking at in our main story on the show today.
Then in our unscience, researchers are suggesting that humans start walking like penguins.
Thank you, science.
Another odd thing.
Hey, I think waddling in penguins and in humans is hilarious. So I support this. I don't even know what it's for. I support it. I'm there. But then later on the show, our scientist behind the sciences, Dr. Rudolf Berger, we will be talking about all things atmospherical and meteorological science, especially cloud seeding. If you didn't know that you can make the clouds rain through science, you'll want to listen to that. Before all of that, we will get into our science news, of course.
And don't forget to share your stories with us on our social media, on Facebook as VowFM, and you can also tweet us at VowFM, hashtag ScienceInside, or you can send your messages to us on our WhatsApp line at 084-078-4912.
Let's get into the show, and let's kick it all off with our science news.
This week's science headline.
Level, what do you have for us?
Okay, today we have a gene that prevents neurodegenerative diseases from occurring in your brain.
Okay, sounds good.
Yes, it is actually. And today my story is from thesciencedaily.com. So Professor Suzanne Ackerman and her colleagues from the University of California, San Diego, have discovered a gene that helps prevent the buildup of harmful proteins in one's body or brain. This gene is called ANKRD16. I'm sure we've all heard of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease, and these diseases, or these disorders rather, are caused by the buildup of those harmful proteins.
Okay, that makes sense. And this gene that has a name straight out of Star Wars. Like, that could be the new robot in Star Wars.
I know, right?
Right?
ANKRD16.
Yep, right. How does this gene work?
Okay, so this gene rescues neurons called Parkinson's cells from their death. And their death is actually caused by the failure in correction of information transfer from the gene to the proteins. An abnormal level of ANKRD16 results in an incorrect activation of amino acid serine triggered by the Purkinje cells. This then causes amino acid serine to incorporate incorrectly with the proteins, resulting in protein accumulation.
Okay. So if you have high levels of this gene, you might prevent these disorders. But what happens if your levels are too low?
Okay. This is according to tests ran on rats. So it hasn't been done on humans, but these low levels can lead to a widespread buildup of protein and eventually neuronal death. So far, researchers have identified a few of these modified genes, ANKRD16 being one of them. This is a sign of hope, though, that scientists will establish a better understanding of the underlying pathology of neurodegenerative diseases and how they actually develop in humans. So I guess we can be a little bit optimistic about the future in neurological sciences and the disorders.
I mean, every time we do this, I say we, every time scientists do this kind of gene work, it sounds like such a small finding, but it can start a whole other, process of finding answers that we wouldn't have known before, and hopefully finding bigger and better solutions to problems like Alzheimer's.
Exactly.
It's exciting.
It's like a positive domino effect.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, Lebel, my story today is not quite that life-changing, but it has the internet and even our office up in arms. But before I get into it, it is this particular story that I'll be talking about is all over the internet. It was made viral by a YouTuber and blogger called Chloe Feldman and covered by all kinds of outlets, including Wired and ASAP Science. But before I get into it, do you remember the dress?
That dress, the four-color dress. There were four colors involved.
Yeah. If you don't remember listening at home, it was a picture of a dress that some people saw as gold and white. That was me when I looked at it, gold and white all the way. And other people saw it as blue and black. I don't know what you saw.
At some points, I did see blue and black, and at some points, I did see white and gold.
Okay, so you were just both teams,
yes,
all over that dress. So this photograph became a viral internet sensation in 2015, and the original color actually was blue and black, but the photograph was overexposed and washed out. So basically, the internet had discovered something that neuroscientists and vision scientists had been looking into for a while, namely that there are differences in human color perception. Now, I have a new controversy for you, Lebel, but this time it's an audio clip where people are hearing either the word Yanny or the word Laurel.
On the same clip?
Yes.
Okay, that's interesting.
So, Katie Hetzel is a teenager who is learning words on a vocabulary website just for her high school, and one of the clips was the word Laurel, but she heard it as Yanny. So a discussion broke out in her class, then the internet, and now it's all over the place. Ellen has covered it, like you name it. They have played this for their audiences. So I thought, even though it's been on the internet for a couple of days, Let's do this here right now and settle it at least at least for the science inside. So we are going to play the clip, and everybody in studio with me here, all of our producers, are going to show us whether they hear Yanni or Laurel. And for you listening at home, why don't you send us a WhatsApp or a tweet? Let us know what you hear, and I will tell you the science just now. But here is the clip.
Laurel.
Okay, let's see some votes here in the studio. I've got to say, I am very, very surprised, because up till now, I have almost always heard Yanni. I just heard Laurel.
I also heard Laurel.
You heard Laurel? Okay, I see some Laurels, but I also see some Yannis. So, very weirdly enough, it seems to be that everybody in our live studio heard Laurel, while everyone in the production studio heard Yanni, which is weird.
What's going on?
It's not just us, it is all over the world. And of course, we are a science show, so we wanted to find out the science, right?
Yes, find out how it works.
Yeah, not just, you know, argue about this and get into a fist fight, which I'm sure some people were ready to do. So first of all, there's something called priming, which I just did with you. Your brain is prepared to hear one of those two words because I told you the options. If I hadn't said Yanni or Laurel, your brain might have heard a weird other combination of those sounds or something that sounds very like it, but because it didn't have any options, but I had given you some, right? Then, very importantly, these two words have similar sound profiles. So if you were to look at them on a sound editing program, for instance, they would look quite similar. But this clip is distorted, so there are lots of high frequencies in this clip, and it depends on what you personally may be able to hear. So let me just explain this a little bit more. The sound of Laurel, so that law, is a low frequency. But the sound of ya has many high frequencies. So you take this original clip, which is Laurel, but it's distorted. So there are high frequencies added to it. Now, some brains on some devices hear this sound, and their brain picks up all of this high frequency, that information that actually isn't there, right? It's only on this particular distortion.
Okay.
And instead of hearing law, it hears a similar sound profile but with higher frequencies, giving it Yanni. Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's so interesting. So it just depends on you, basically.
Well, no, because some people hear Yanni sometimes and Laurel other times. So I have heard both Yanni and Laurel over the last few days, depending on what device I'm on, depending on even, you know, just the particular day, whatever it might be. My brain has even switched between the two on the same track at the same, like, in the same sort of listening.
Oh, wow.
So there's a assistant professor at Boston University, and he calls this, his name is Tyler Parashione, and he says this is a bistable illusion. Because your brain basically jumps between these two stable options. But we still don't know why a brain would suddenly decide to do this. So it does also depend on other things, like whether you are older, because older people don't quite hear the higher frequency, so they will be more likely to hear Laurel.
Okay, I'm embarrassed now.
So maybe you and I have just aged a lot. It also does, of course, depend on your particular device. So maybe if you're listening at home now, you've actually heard something different than what you've heard if you've listened on your earphones.
Oh, wow. So it's an illusion at the end of the day.
Yes, exactly. So the other cool thing about this auditory illusion is whether you hear a voice that is more male or more female. So since men tend to have lower pitch voices and longer vocal tracts, if you're hearing Laurel, you're more likely to think that it's a man who's saying it. But the shorter and higher Yanni sound that some people are hearing may resemble a woman's pitch more.
Oh my gosh.
It's the dress for radio, you guys.
Wow.
So if you now start a fight with somebody about the Laurel or Yanny thing, at least I've fueled your fight with some good science.
Exactly. I've got some solid facts to lay down.
You are on the Science Inside, where we love science about crazy things, but also about some serious things. So next up, we get into our main story of the day, the journey your medicine goes through from headache pills to life-saving drugs. We will talk about how an idea becomes a packet on your shelf.
You're listening to The Science Inside, bringing you science around major news events.
Welcome to the show. My name is Alna Schütz.
And I'm Lebogang Madisha.
Remember, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter as VowFM, hashtag Science Inside. But let's get into our main story for the day.
Yes, today we're talking about aspirin. And Aspen Pharmacare has opened a new facility in Port Elizabeth worth 1 billion rand. It may be simple popping a pill for a headache or whatever, but the procedure behind it is definitely not straightforward or quick at all.
Because of this news story, we are going to take a more general look today into the behind the scenes of your medicine, whatever that medicine might be. And we want to look at the process from A to B, from idea to shelf. Where does this medicine come from? Because it's not just somebody who's like mixing together some like small nyana herbs hoping that it'll help you. Like, there is quite a thorough and quite a long scientific process here. And the drug development process really starts with studying the disease to find out what the causes and targets are. And then you say, okay, we're developing this new drug compound and we think it's going to effectively fight this particular disease. Let's start this process with Professor Kelly Chibale, the chair in drug development at the Department of Chemistry at the University of Cape Town, just explaining how the process begins in terms of researching and creating the drug.
The process of discovering and developing a drug cause is to understand what is the nature of the disease, what has caused it. The next stage that we move to is what we call a target-based approach. If that we identified that target, what we then have to do is to validation of the target. So we can clone, we can express that protein, that target, and we can purify it, which then allows us in the laboratory to develop an assay or a test whereby we can find chemicals of what will one day become drugs or medicine. And then from there, we start then optimizing those inhibitors for efficacy and safety. Only then do we commence human clinical trials.
Okay, so once the possible drug is developed, it needs to get tested, right?
Yes. Before human trials, there's preclinical trials, which, yes, means animal trials. I know we hear about this a lot, but that is the first step to make sure that the drug is safe.
I know it's required, but I still feel sorry for the little critters. Like, shame, man.
Yeah, every time we cover this in the news, my like little vegetarian heart gets a little bit sore. But it is part of the process, yes. And thankfully, there are quite a lot of animal rights regulations in place around this. We go now to Dr. Nicola Lister, the Chief Scientific Officer at Novartis Southern Africa.
Animal tests are still required from a drug testing perspective. But having said that, there is a lot of regulation and very strict laws in place that govern the types of animals that can be used and how many animals can be used. So there really is a drive towards reducing the number of animals that are used in preclinical testing and certainly the smaller animals, so rats, mice, those sort of animals would be used more readily than larger animals.
So they are very aware of it, thankfully, and even though it is still required, there are lots of sort of legalities and regulations around animal testing, at least for medical drugs. But now it's time for our medicine to be tested on real, live humans. Clinical trials are, of course, very carefully designed to look at the risks and side effects of a particular drug. And we're being very general here. It very much depends on what kind of drug it is, whether it's a new drug or an old drug, just what's happening in general. But there are usually 4 different phases, starting with a small number of healthy volunteers. The volunteers are given small doses of the drug treatment to study the general safety of this new medicine.
These are called clinical epidemiology studies, where we're looking at pharmacoeconomics and pharmacodynamics, and that really is looking at what the drug does to the body and what the body does to the drug in a healthy volunteer. We then can start testing in the target patient population. So, for example, if we're trying a drug to lower high blood pressure, for example, we would then give the drug to a small group of people who actually have high blood pressure to see if the drug works, and also to see which is the best dose of the drug. And that's called a phase 2 clinical trial.
Okay, so after phase 2, you have a good idea of whether the drug is safe or not, if it's working somewhat, and you know how much to give to patients.
Yeah.
Are you done after that?
Not quite yet. So now the really big stuff starts. Phase 3 and 4 is where it goes out to a large number of patients and the side effects are monitored and just generally how much the drug works. We're talking often, you know, thousands of, you know, 1,000, 3,000, 5,000, whatever it might be, patients around the world that it gets tested on, just to make sure that different ethnicities, different kind of people, different ages, all kinds of things use this drug before it gets on the market. Because this whole process obviously needs to be very carefully monitored. That being said, sometimes the drug can be compared to the available drug on the market, and the new drug may then be accepted if it has a greater effect than the available one. So this, of course, isn't just for new drugs. So most of the global drug development in the world happens by big multinationals, and they then use clinical patients from all over, as I said, including trials in South Africa.
Now, those are typically, you know, the trials that you hear about that include thousands of patients across the world in multiple different centres, and they will take the drug for a predetermined period of time to see, you know, what the safety and efficacy profile of that drug is. And depending, again, you know, what the product is and what the regulators require from a data perspective, that drug will then go on to be registered.
So now you have made it, you have decided this is your particular medicine that you want to put to market, and you have to register it. This usually happens at the American FDA, the Food and Drug Association, and probably the European Medicines Authority first, and then trickles down around the world to other regulators.
Oh, that's why we're always getting medicines later than every other country in the world.
Yes, that's one of the reasons, because we're not the big guns. So it sort of takes a while to register here. You do have to submit quite a lot of documents. It includes every little piece of data and evidence from the entire process, from research all the way through preclinical trials and then phases 1 to 4. The different committees then decide on everything from the statistical power to the clinical evidence, all kinds of things. And if everything goes well and they say, yes, this is convincing, then the company gets a registration for the drug. But before it goes to market, you still need a patent, or at least the right to own this particular medicine. I asked Alison Dyer, a consultant on intellectual property and patenting for Spur and Fisher, about this.
Generally, a patent application on a drug is filed very early on in the life of the drug, so probably before anyone knows, in fact, which is going to be the active ingredient that's going to work. The patent application will be filed. It then proceeds through a prosecution process in the various patent offices of the world, some of which are examination patent offices, where they will do searches to determine what was known before this invention and therefore the value of the invention. At the end of this process, patents will be granted, and thereafter the patents will provide the protection for the drug for the life of the patent, which is generally 20 years from date of application till expiry.
I do have to explain that this original patent is often about a particular molecule compound, but there are various other kinds of patents, such as a new use of an old pharmaceutical. We don't have time to go into this fully. There could be a whole story just about the patenting system in South Africa, but let me just say there have been several problems with the medical patenting system here that just mean that very often people can't access what they want to, what they need at affordable rates. And it is a process, but still there are quite a lot of problems, and I encourage you to read up about it on your own. But unfortunately, just for the sake of time, I can't quite go into this. But okay, let's say everything goes well, you're patented. That's the next step.
And so once the medicine thingy has covered all these challenges and it's crossed all these hurdles, it needs to make it to the shelves, right?
Yes. So you now have it, you have your pole, you've chosen the color. I'm kidding. But everything is done. That is the last step. Let's go back to Dr. Lister.
We then go through a process of getting drug into the country, basically. So there would be a lot of different players within the pharmaceutical company. The regulatory guys would make sure that the product label was all up to scratch, and as per what has been approved by the local regulator. There's packaging and artwork of the product. There is the supply chain management who would need to, order the drug from the overseas factories. And South African rules dictate that we have to quarantine the product and do quality testing on the post-importation batch, just to make sure that none of the elements of the drug have changed in its route to South Africa. And only once we get that clearance can we then send to the wholesalers, and that's where pharmacies can order the product.
Okay, cool. Now I can go get the meds.
Yes, technically yes, but obviously a lot of these drugs still have to be prescribed by a doctor. So if it's first in class, which means that it's a new kind of medicine, they have to do quite a lot of a campaign around it, making sure that doctors understand the research, what this particular drug does that's new or different. They have to explain when and how and what kind of side effects, all that stuff, so that your doctor is aware of it, right? And they might have to work with pharmacies and individuals, just making sure that it's not just sitting on the shelves where people can actually access it. But once it's out on the shelves, the scientists don't sleep on it. They actually still keep an eye on this medicine just to make sure that once it's out there, it's still safe. Here's Professor Jibale again.
Pharmacovigilance is a very important part of the studies when a drug is given to people. And you see, we have to report adverse drug reactions that were never picked up in the clinical trials. And of course, if those things are investigated and they become serious, then the medicine could be withdrawn.
So that is the whole process from idea to shelf. And it can take well over a decade from this initial idea to a product that you and I can buy. Our local regulator alone can take between 5 and 6 years.
Oh my gosh, that is a very long time.
I do have to say that sometimes the trials are cut short, which can be a good thing or a bad thing. So if it's very clear that a drug is not working at all, there's no real point in them continuing. And if it's really clear that the drug is working amazingly well in comparison to a previous treatment, they might also cut it short and say, go for it.
Yeah.
So those are two factors that come into it, but most of the time it takes quite a while, especially for the formal registration process. And that's the problem, because meanwhile, there are patients all over the world that desperately would like, and by like I mean desperately need, this medication. And, there are things being done just trying to get this process to go faster. Here's Dr. Lister again.
We need to do things better. We need to get faster. There's a lot of emphasis at the moment, specifically trying to get the regulatory process speeded up. But from a research development perspective, we're now in an era where we are using data and digital technologies to our advantage. There's so many very smart people out there that are developing ways and means of speeding up the way, potential drug candidates are processed by artificial intelligence, and then coming up with potential candidates that have a much higher probability of success than they ever did in the past. Because in the past, we've perhaps used sort of quite antiquated systems, or we've relied on people to, you know, go through the data and make those decisions. We have so much data available that if we could just plug a certain algorithm into it, it could then make those decisions for us and speed up the whole process.
The process is still going to take quite a while, but it's pretty great that AI can help get the medicine to patients sooner, at least hopefully in the future. And then, you know, companies like Aspen Pharmacare can pump out these drugs that are saving lives and, you know, curing headaches everywhere.
Yes, and hopefully if you're not a big shot country, they'll try and quicken this process too for you.
So I do have to tell you, just finishing this off, Lebo, obviously, we spoke a lot about the clinical trials and how many people around the world are involved in this. And do you remember that part where healthy participants help check that things are safe?
Yes.
So just between you, me, and the rest of our listeners, I may have been one of these human guinea pigs in my time.
Oh, wow. So you just go and then they shoot you up with whatever they have on trial and then hopefully you don't die.
That is not exactly how it works. But in theory, yes. So while I was a student, I made some good money off of being a pharmaceutical testing subject.
Okay, I'm down for this. Contact everything. I'm here for it.
So I have quite a good memory when it comes to these things, and I hope the things that I tested one day helped somebody with I was specifically involved in eczema creams and skin creams, testing them on healthy individuals. So I hope somewhere out there, if you suffer of eczema, I might have helped that medicine get on the shelf for you.
Hopefully. And hopefully nothing actually happened to you?
No.
Like no side effects, nothing?
No. I think being weird is not an effect of that. That was there beforehand. You are still listening to The Science Inside. And up next, we do get into more weird science with our feature, Unscience.
This is The Science Inside with Elna.
Okay, nerds, it's time for Unscience, the little bit of the show where we look at the stranger side of research. It's where we have a peek at the weird and wonderful side of what scientists spend a lot of time, effort, and money on. Today's Unscience was produced by Gloria Mabuza, and it is with music from Audio Lounge and Lux Stock. Let's get into it. It's Unscience time.
Unusual. Unlikely. Unscience.
Okay, Lebo, let's get into it.
Okay, so it's winter in South Africa now, and it's all chilly and cold, but have you ever wondered how people living in snow-dominated areas around the world survive on slipping snow?
Snow is quite slippery. Thankfully, yes. I live in Pretoria where there is no snow ever. But I am not the most confident person on my feet in, you know, I'm pretty clumsy on a good day. So I think on snow it wouldn't be too great.
Okay, so what I'm actually about to tell you is going to be great news for South Africans living in Drakensberg or Eastern Cape or any other areas in the country with annual winter snow.
Sounds dramatic. What's happening?
Okay. So a German trauma surgeon advised Germans to walk like penguins. Okay. Why would you want to walk like a penguin, right? This is to avoid slipping on pavements when freezing temperatures and snow appears in the winter season.
Are you sure this wasn't like published on the 1st of April? Because I feel like doctors are just having fun now, telling us to walk like penguins. It sounds more like a scene from, you remember that movie, Happy Feet?
Yes.
With the dancing penguins.
Yep. It does sort of sound like it. I feel like the doctors are going to be watching us like, look at those dumb people walking like penguins. Yeah. But anyway, it would be a funny sight, right? But an advisory has been published on a website of a German Society of Orthopedics and Trauma Surgeons that says that walking like these aquatic birds would actually help you not to slip. This means that when you're walking, you'll have to lean a little bit forward so that your center of gravity is centered like in front of you.
Okay, I get that.
And then the waddle will keep your center of gravity in front of your legs and will keep you upright. So by leaning forward, you keep yourself upright.
Okay.
Now here's for a little how to do for you, people who want to walk like a penguin. What you need to do is to spread your feet out slightly to increase your center of gravity and take small steps. Then you also need your hands out of your pockets, because walking with your hands in your pockets will decrease your center of gravity and balance.
Because this sounds hilarious in my head. I feel like I'm going to do this in the city, Joburg, just for fun. There doesn't even need to be snow. I just...
like on a random sunny day, start walking like a penguin.
Yeah, just don't we all want to look like that?
Okay, well, when humans walk normally, their body weight is actually split almost evenly between both legs. And according to the surgeons, this increases their loss of balance and thus falling on slippery surfaces.
Okay, so that's what would normally happen if you walk like a human. So penguins have something down.
Yes, they have that down. And what I'm about to tell you is actually a little bit funny, right?
Okay.
The funny thing is, another piece of research that was conducted by Timothy Griffin in University of California showed that although penguins walk gracefully on ice, on land, they're quite an adorable mess.
Listen, first of all, I'm not sure you would classify them as graceful. Because even on ice...
even on ice, they look a little bit funny, like yeah. wobble-de-wobble-de-wobble. Yeah.
But okay, I'm intrigued.
Okay, they usually move their bodies to and fro to shuffle one stubby little leg in front of the other.
Okay, so I guess they kind of have the, you know, we have the upper hand in this. At least we look graceful. We humans look graceful on land.
Okay, people like seeing themselves as above everyone. So before you start judging, because of that little cartoonish walk, it's actually quite an efficient walk for animals in the animal kingdom. At least on ice.
Okay, so basically you're saying humans should like take a tutorial from penguins if you're planning to walk on anything slippery.
Yes, basically. Call up your penguin friends and tell them to teach you how to walk like them. But then again, this knowledge gained from penguins will provide novel insight into walking mechanisms for humans with increased lateral movements, such as pregnant women and obese individuals.
No, guy. I was with you on the slippery snow, but we cannot be giving medical advice to pregnant ladies to walk like penguins.
I know, it doesn't sound right. Like you're carrying a baby in front of you. You're going to lean forward. Aren't you going to fall? But anyway, it's scientifically proven, so we got to go with it. Penguins have it.
Okay.
And adding on what has been already said, the University of Utah and Iowa State University issued tips for walking safely in winter weather. Some of them include wearing shoes with grip, walking at a little bit of a slower pace, and using handrails when using the stairs when entering and exiting buildings. And yeah,
I guess those are good tips if you don't want to look like a penguin, which is nobody. I think everybody secretly wants to do a little waddle when they're, you know, walking into the office. Waddle, waddle.
I mean, one of those days when you're feeling like being awkward, just walk in into a very serious meeting like a penguin.
Yeah, right.
Wobble-de-wob.
But I feel like you need the whole, like, hands by your side, like little wings. Otherwise, it's not real, right?
Yeah. Just dress like a penguin then.
I cannot believe that this is actually what scientists have said, but I've got to give it to you. It does seem legit.
It does. They've got the facts to prove it, so why not believe them?
That was your unusual and likely unscience for the day.
If you want to find penguins, down you go to the bottom of the earth at the South Pole. Antarctica is the place where you find the most penguins taking up space.
Unusual, unlikely, unscience. Stay curious, stay informed, stay on the science inside.
You're still on The Science Inside, and now we get to the part where we look at the scientists behind the science.
Today we'll be speaking to Dr. Rudolf Berger, who is a physical geographer. His research focuses mainly on atmospheric processes, climatology, meteorology, and remote sensing. Yes, we're talking about the weather, but I promise you it's very interesting. He has carried out studies on interactions between aerosols and the atmosphere, reducing fuel burning emissions in South Africa and biomass burning in a larger sense. His expertise and findings on atmospheric research got him recognition by the Weather Modification Association, landing him the Weather Modification Field Meteorologist Distinguished Service Award last month in the United States. Dr. Berger is actually a former Wits University graduate and currently works at the School of Environmental Sciences and Development at Northwest University. He also plays a very important role in the climatology research group of the Lequena Weather Radar. That's a high-end weather radar that was launched just earlier this year, and it studies and measures storms and rainfall in its surrounding areas, as well as assisting researchers by providing real-time data that significantly improves weather observation networks. That's what he works on, but we want to find out both about his work and himself as a scientist. Thank you so much, Dr. Berger, for joining us on The Science Inside.
No problem. And you can call me Rudolf. That's fine.
Well, we always love being casual here, just to make science something that's more close to home. I want to talk to you about your work that really goes far beyond just predicting what the weather will be like the next day or, you know, is a major storm approaching. You've looked quite a lot into matters like air quality control and air quality management. Take us a bit into this field of research. What have you been working on?
So I call myself a physical geographer, and the nice and fun thing about geographers is we get to stick our fingers into everybody's business. So that means if you listen to the kind of stuff we do, it sounds pretty broad. But in today's age, multidisciplinary type research is really avant-garde, you know, and that is exactly what geographers do. We typically look at big picture problems, and then we approach it from a multidisciplinary point of view. And typically, we'll be the glue in the study. So we'll work together with specialists from different fields, and then bring together their expertise. And then we are the focus on the big problem, right? And that's why we do quite a wide variety of stuff. So if you want more specifics, I can tell you a bit more specifically about the different projects we're busy with.
So let's hone in on one particular project that I find very interesting. Our listeners may have heard of something called cloud seeding, which is a process that basically brings the rain, so to say. And you've looked at whether this might be a possibility for South Africa. And I'm sure a lot of listeners' thoughts will immediately go to systems, to places like Cape Town, where, you know, there's been a lot of need for rain. What have your findings been around these kind of technologies and their availability or their applicability for places like South Africa?
Sure. So this is a huge topic, and I can talk for hours. I'll try and be brief. But cloud seeding research started just after the Second World War, and there was one famous experiment where a company in the U.S. flew with a big plane, and they threw dry ice onto a very specific kind of cloud. And they drew the company's logo on the clouds. And as they were flying, the clouds rained out, and they took a picture of this. And it's this old, grainy, black and white picture. But that sort of started this idea that we as humans can change rainfall patterns. And since then, there's been lots of activities around the world. At some point, there were more than 140 projects in different countries around the world trying to change cloud processes. And I've been fortunate to visit many of these projects. And I was also part of the tail end of the South African cloud seeding project that was called the National Precipitation Research Project, which was done in collaboration between the South African Weather Service and a company called CloudQuest and funded by the Water Research Commission. And this was a groundbreaking project. At the time, the results of this project was highly acclaimed around the world. And because of the very dramatic results, it was reanalyzed by about three different groups independently and basically coming to the same conclusion. And that conclusion stands to this day, and that is that although we don't fully understand the mechanism yet, there seems to be enough evidence to suggest that it might be possible to augment rainfall. And that now means the specific kind of rainfall that we get on the high veld of South Africa. Mm. In other parts of the world, they target other types of rainfall. So each climate have specific set of rain-producing processes, and therefore your techniques to try and modify needs to match the specific climate that you experience. And in some climates, it's much easier than in others. So, for example, in cold climates that experience lots of snow, there's been even greater successes. One project that comes to mind is one that has been running in Wyoming in the United States. And there they've had very positive results over the last few years.
Mm. And yet,
if you're thinking about Cape Town,
right,
then we haven't done any research in South Africa around Cape Town, but it is feasible that it might be something to look at, right? So it's not an easy question to answer, and it's not a definite yes, but it's a definitely maybe.
Hmm. And who knows? We know that sometimes the wheels of science can turn quite slowly, and it might be an answer to future problems or future crises around arid areas. A
sure.
Different problem that is already quite quite problematic and quite big around the world now, of course, is air pollution, especially,
yep.
Taking climate change into account. And you've done some research around this, and specifically trying to find some clues into how we would reduce air pollution in South Africa.
Sure. And hopefully you see the link there between on the one hand, we were trying to study what can we do to intentionally change processes in the atmosphere, and there's a natural link between us unintentionally changing processes. One example is climate change, but the other one is changing rainfall processes through air pollution. So that was sort of the way we got into the problem of air pollution. And we did a project studying the interaction of air pollution and rain. And then in the last few years, there's been a renewed focus from government on understanding air pollution in South Africa, understanding the different sources that contribute to pollution, and then understanding the impacts. And we've made quite a bit of progress. We've done some studies in low-income areas. A few examples would be one a township called Kwadela between Ermelo and Bethal. And then we've also worked in Sasselburg, Secunda, in and around Joburg. So we've done quite a few studies in these areas. And once again, if you remember, I said as a geographer, we do this as a team of people. So we typically have social scientists that help us when we approach a community like this, so that we do it responsibly and ethically. But also, mm-hmm. We're trying to understand the mechanisms behind some of these pollution sources. And some of those involve humans. And so, therefore, you need the social scientists to guide you in this interactions. And then, on the other hand, you need
the scientists and engineers who bring their complicated equipment, and we would deploy these whole range of instruments trying to measure and quantify from a more cold clinical point of view what is the exact levels that people are exposed to. So the results of these studies is that especially the poor of South Africa are exposed to very high levels of pollution, right, and that it has a drastic impact on health. So in collaboration with social scientists, we've been testing different ways of trying to see if we can address some of these. One example I can mention is that in many of the low-income areas on the Highveld, solid fuel burning is one of their primary sources of energy. And what would typically happen is on the cold winter nights, people have to find some kind of solid fuel to heat their house. And the fact that they have very poorly insulated and poorly built houses aggravates this problem. Mm-hmm. So we had a project where we tried to see what would be the impact if we went and insulated people's houses. So a small little township of around 1,000 households, we went and insulated every house that we could find, and then making measurements in and outside of temperatures and making measurements of pollution in and outside of households. We were trying to see what the impact would be. And the one impact was drastic reduction in exposure to extreme cold and extreme warm conditions in the houses, which already has a huge health benefit. But then also some indications that there's an improvement in air quality.
Right.
So that's the kind of stuff we're working on.
You have worked on, and you are working on, some incredible things in the field, really trying to find very practical solutions to problems that I think feel so hopeless to a lot of people, like air pollution. And it's very encouraging to hear your work. We've been talking to Dr. Roelof Burger, who's a physical geographer currently at Northwest University. Thank you so much for joining us. Unfortunately, we have run out of time, but it's been an interesting conversation. You are still on the Science Inside. After this, we say goodbye.
Stay curious, stay informed, stay on the Science Inside.
Lebo, today on the show we've had all kinds of things, from waddling like penguins,
my favorite,
to where our medicine comes from and all of the scientific processes that goes into one small nyana pill.
And the cost and time that goes into all of that. Your little panado has gone through the most to reach your little tongue.
I definitely have a lot more respect for all medication now. But it's been a good show.
It really has. And thanks to all our guests featured on the show, including Dr. Roelof Burger, Dr. Nicholas Lister, Professor Kelly Chibali, and Alison Dyer.
Our team behind the scenes is, of course, our production team, Bridget Lepere, Harmony Malefi, and Gloria Mabuza, and tech, as always, by Kutlwano Sarame.
And you can catch us on our podcast on podcastvids.journalism.co.za/science. And you can check us out on our social media and share your stories with us on Facebook as The Science Inside. And you can also tweet us at VowFM.
I also want to jump in there and say we are on iTunes. So if you don't want to find the podcast on the website, you can find us on iTunes, which is very new and very exciting. You've been listening to Lebohang Madisha and myself, Alna Schutz. The Science Inside is produced by the Wits Radio Academy, funded in part by the South African Department of Science and Technology. Join us again for more weird and wonderful science next week.
The Science Inside, Monday from 6 to 7 p.m. on Power FM 88.1. We'll be right back.
The Science Inside Podcast.